As Mary Gough walked down the aisle on her wedding day, she felt a little overwhelmed. She was about to start a new life with her long-term boyfriend, hopefully start a family and live happily ever after. So why did she feel this way? Maybe it was that she was missing her father, who died when she was just 15 years old, unable to walk his only daughter down the aisle. Maybe it was because she was naturally shy. She didn't like being the centre of attention. And on the other side of that church door, there were dozens of people waiting to see her and dote on her for the entire day. Maybe, though, deep down, Mary knew that this was all a lie. That Colin Whelan, the man she was about to marry, was not the man he made himself out to be. That he had a dark side that nobody else knew about, and one that she was terrified of. In their wedding video, Colin is seen looking lovingly down on his new wife. They pose for photos, they cut their wedding cake, and they do all the things couples do on what is supposed to be the happiest day of their lives. But Colin is distracted, because in the back of his mind, he is already calculating how to kill Mary and cash in on their £400,000 life insurance policy. Welcome back to Red Room, everyone, part of the Acast network. I am your host, Jenny Claffey, and this week, as part of our new true crime season, we're looking at an infamous true crime case from Ireland, the murder of Mary Gough by her husband, Colin Whelan.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So who were Mary Gough and Colin Whelan? Mary Gough was born in Meath in 1974 to a large family of four boys. She was her parents' only daughter. She was described as an independent child and the life of the family. Growing up, she was closest to her mother. The pair had a special bond, being that they were the only two women in the household full of boys. When Mary's father died suddenly when she was just 15 years old, her and her mother's bond only strengthened. She hated school growing up, although she never skipped it. Mary attended St. Patrick's School in Stamullen, where she had many pals, including her lifelong friend, Sinead Howard. She was a bit of a tomboy and loved the rough and tumble of country life. She had no airs or graces about her and led a carefree life in the tranquil village of Stamullen, County Meath. She got a job at a local pub when she finished school called The Huntsman, and it was in a nearby town called Gormanstown. This is where she would meet Colin Whelan, a local boy who was a few years older than her, from a similar family, and who would be her first and only boyfriend. Colin was intelligent and had studied computer science. He had also recently got a job in Dublin as a computer analyst. The couple began dating, but Colin broke everything off very suddenly with Mary in 1995. Her family would say this breakup was so sudden it devastated her for a while. Despite the heartbreak, Mary was resilient, and she moved on in her life. She got a new and exciting job working in a film company for a few months, and then she settled in a solicitor's office as a legal secretary. Her life was going well without Colin. She finally felt like she was getting over her first love, but, as many of us do, she got back with him after 6 months of being apart. Colin had now bought a house in Balbriggan. It was an old family home, and she moved in immediately. It finally seemed like Colin was ready for a committed relationship with Mary. In 1997, Colin went out on a night out to the Huntsman, the pub where he and Mary had met. On his way home, he got into a huge car crash. His car collided with another, one that was being driven by an older local man, whose wife rode in the passenger seat. Both the man and woman were in their 60s, and they both got injured, but the woman, Mrs. Murphy, sustained the most serious of those injuries, and she would actually die from them in hospital. Colin would be charged with drunk and reckless driving, but the couple tried to carry on with their lives as best they could. Mary and Colin went on a much-needed holiday to Fuerteventura in 1998, and this would be where Colin would pop the question to Mary. He asked her to marry him, and Mary was overjoyed. Her childhood sweetheart, who she had just given a second chance to, was ready to marry her, and they would hopefully start their own family one day. They did up the house that Colin had bought a few years back, and Mary's mom moved in pretty much. Mary even made up a guest room for her as her room. But in the background, Colin was still facing these drunk driving and reckless driving charges, resulting in death, which he was planning on pleading not guilty to. When the court case came around, he pled not guilty to both drunk driving and dangerous driving. Surprisingly, the court found Colin not guilty of drunk driving and then withdrew all other charges without evidence or explanation. Colin escaped what would have been a life-altering verdict. He was found guilty of careless driving and only got a small fine of £350 and a six-month driving ban. Something that must have been very hard to deal with for the family of the local woman whose life was ended in the car accident. The couple started to plan their wedding, seeing as now they could put the court case behind them once and for all. Mary would plan the wedding along with her mother. Her mother would later note, though, that Colin showed a bizarre and strange interest in all of the planning meetings, one that she did not expect him to. But she felt it was not out of interest in the wedding itself, but more of a controlling thing, that he wanted to make sure Mary wasn't left alone, especially with her mother. The wedding went ahead and the couple were married on the 9th of September in the year 2000. On her wedding day, Mary was said to be nervous. Her big brother gave her away, since their father, who had died, could not. Mary's mother would later say Mary didn't seem happy on her wedding day, but it's obviously easy to say this knowing what we know now. One unusual thing is that apparently Mary burst into tears after the ceremony and ran back into the church, something that was at the time put down to her missing her father. But in hindsight, you can't help but wonder what was really going through Mary's mind. Her good friend Sinead also said that Mary told her that when she turned up on her wedding day and realised that she was going to be the centre of attention, she just got so anxious and overwhelmed. Mary just wasn't the type of person who wanted or needed to be the star of the show. After their wedding, Mary and Colin went on a honeymoon of a lifetime. They travelled across Southeast Asia, but when they returned home, her mother said everything was different. She, Marie Goff, was not allowed or welcome to stay in the home anymore. This is the home that she had pretty much moved into beforehand. In fact, she never stayed there again after the couple were wed, and Mary began cancelling plans on her. Her friends, however, felt that everything seemed normal enough, and Mary and Colin seemed to be enjoying newlywed life. On March 2nd, 2001, just 6 months into married life, at 12:16 a.m, Colin Whelan alerted emergency services. He said that his new wife Mary had fallen down the stairs and he needed an ambulance ASAP. During the 999 call, he said, my wife, she needs an ambulance, she's fallen down the stairs. He added that he didn't think she was breathing, that she was bleeding pretty badly from her nose and her mouth. He said she was turning blue and he couldn't feel a pulse no matter how hard he tried to find one. The operator on the other line tried to calm him down and they instructed him on how to give CPR in an attempt to keep whatever life Mary had there until, of course, paramedics would arrive and take over. Colin said he was doing so, but that her chest wasn't moving. When the fire department and the paramedics arrived, they found Mary on the ground at the foot of the stairs, covered in a heavy duvet, which Colin said the dispatcher on the phone told him to use to keep her warm. Paramedics noticed how he had no blood on his hands or his face, despite him saying that he had given his wife CPR before they arrived, and Mary was bleeding pretty heavily from her nose and her mouth. Mary's condition was much worse than they thought, though. She was freezing cold despite them arriving in just 20 minutes after the call was made. Colin's demeanour was described as frantic and distraught. He kept asking if she was dead. He said Mary must have caught herself in the banister. He told them to look at her dressing gown. The sleeve was torn. She must have caught herself on the banister. Alarm bells began to ring when first responders discovered that Mary had flatlined and they were unable to restart her heart, which was unusual if she died when her husband said she had. He kept asking if Mary was dead, getting angrier in his approach every time. When a paramedic told him that they just couldn't confirm his wife's status yet, Colin lashed out and swore at them. Mary was brought to Beaumont Hospital. While Mary was brought in the ambulance, Colin and his brother-in-law drove to family members' homes to tell them that something had happened to Mary and that they needed to come with them, quick. They said Colin sat in the car with his head in his hands. Meanwhile, doctors and first responders were working tirelessly to revive Mary, but nothing was working. She was pronounced dead at 1:35 a.m. They inspected the body and noticed swelling on her tongue and bruising near her larynx that was not consistent with a fall down the stairs. They decided pretty soon that although Mary died in the hospital, a post-mortem would have to be conducted. By this time, Colin and his family and Mary's family arrived at the hospital and were told that Mary had not survived. The hospital workers went to Colin for more details on what happened to Mary, who seemed to be a healthy 27-year-old without any chronic illnesses. He said when he found her, she wasn't moving, but her eyes, he thinks they were fluttering. While Colin was speaking to the nurses, he made his first mistake. He leaned over and his slightly open shirt showed his chest. One nurse noticed that it had scratches all over it. Her alarm bells went off, but she remained calm as Colin told her about his version of events that night. Mary was prepared for an autopsy. Her mother arrived, as did the police, who had to ask Colin some routine questions about the night and the day beforehand. Colin said it was a regular day. He had gone to work in Dublin, and he even picked up a present for Mary in Brown Thomas, which is a luxury department store here in Dublin, to match one of their wedding gifts. When he got home, he went to the gym. He got back from the gym, they had dinner, and then they had to drive to Dundalk to collect some test results for Mary. When they got home, he said they took turns showering and went to bed. It was so normal, it was almost boring. But doctors noticed that there were gaps and issues with the story, like Colin saying that she had washed herself and washed her hair, yet there being no sign of soap or shampoo on her body despite having only showered a few hours ago. The nurse who had seen the scratch marks on Colin had by this time told a police officer what she'd seen, and then the police asked Colin about the scratches. Colin was immediately defensive. He said he had no scratches. They pointed them out to him. And when they asked him to take his top off, they noticed there were long red marks all over him. He looked shocked and said, oh, Mary must have scratched him, adding that Mary had actually reached out to him when he found her, despite earlier on saying that she was pretty close to death. The hospital staff insisted on examining the scratches. And when Colin took off his shirt, they saw multiple areas that had similar scrapes and scratches, all of which were consistent with fingernail scrapes that they had seen in the past. Colin still stuck by his story that Mary had fallen to her death in their home, but suspicions were already bubbling in the hospital. Meanwhile, the state pathologist was conducting a post-mortem. Forensic pathologist Professor Marie Cassidy was the first female in the country to hold the position of state pathologist. At the time of this case, she had already been practicing forensic pathology for 15 years. A forensic pathologist investigates sudden or unnatural deaths in collaboration with law enforcement. They determine the cause of death and provide expert testimony when needed. Dr. Cassidy was immediately suspicious because Mary had none of the usual injuries associated with a fatal fall down the stairs. Her neck and spine were not broken. In fact, she had no broken bones. Mary had deep bruising, however, to the muscles in her neck and broken blood vessels in her eyes. There was also a faint ligature mark, something that the average person would miss, but it was there, and Mary's tongue was swollen. When Dr. Cassidy was finished her post-mortem, she told Detective Inspector Patrick Murray, "You have a murder on your hands." She was certain of it. In fact, when asked how sure she was, she answered, "I am 110% sure." In the days following Mary's death, police started doing some digging on Colin. After all, he was the last person to see Mary alive. He was her husband, and by his own account, the only other person in the house that night. By all accounts, he was a well-liked guy, whose movements of that day could be corroborated. While the Gardaí were being told they had a murder on their hands, they simply could not find a motive. They wondered if there was an affair afoot. Had the couple any enemies? Any outstanding debts? All of these lines of questioning led to pretty much nothing. The police then got a warrant to search Colin's workplace and home computers. On his home computer, they found absolutely nothing significant, other than that the search history had been wiped. This made police more suspicious, but still lacking a motive. Police continued their search, and on his work computer, the history of which was saved on an external server, they found something that went beyond suspicious and was just straight up incriminating. Colin Whelan's search history was full of terms like asphyxiate, choking, how to block a windpipe, and how long does it take to die from choking. This went beyond morbid curiosity and was straight up research, all taking place right up to the month before Mary would die. Furthermore, they saw Colin was researching murder cases online. One case he seemed fascinated with was the case of Henry Wallace, also known as the Taco Bell serial killer. Henry Wallace killed 11 women between March 1990 and 1994, all by strangulation. His signature move was strangling these women without leaving a ligature mark. In one of the cases, Wallace had used a towel as an attempt to minimize the ligature mark on his victim. Henry Wallace had also used a duvet or a blanket to keep victims' bodies warm as to obscure the time of death, something which Colin also did to Mary. They knew at this stage that Mary had not died by a fall but was murdered by strangulation. Pathologist Dr. Cassidy was so convinced that she'd been strangled, she returned to the scene of the alleged crime, looking for a murder weapon this time. But there was nothing. As she walked through the house, something caught her eye. A dressing gown hanging on the back of the bedroom floor. On it, there was red staining on the material at the back. It looked like blood. The blood was on the dressing gown tie, or belt, and this belt was taken as evidence and sent to forensic science labs, which confirmed staining was Mary's blood. Police soon realised an assault had definitely taken place, and Colin Whelan became the main suspect of the murder, despite having no previous domestic violence complaints or any violent history that they were aware of. Forensic testing in their home found evidence that was consistent with Mary being strangled and killed near the door of their bedroom and then moved. Gardaí believed that Colin Whelan strangled his wife in the bedroom and dragged her backwards down the hallway. He wrapped her body in a duvet to distort the time of death so that he would have time to clean up the murder scene. They then concluded that her body was moved to the bottom of the stairs, staging an accident before emergency services were called when Colin already knew that his wife had died. This was methodical and calculated. There was nothing accidental about it. Although police were now almost certain that Colin Whelan had killed his wife, they still had no motive. While searching the home, investigators also discovered evidence that provided one, though. In June 2000, just 9 months before Mary's death, Colin Whelan had taken out an insurance policy for himself and his wife for a 10-year period. This life insurance policy would pay €500,000 to the spouse who survived. This policy was, according to an independent financial advisor, inappropriate and highly questionable. But according to the insurance company, they had sold it to them, which was unusually large, because Colin and Mary were both considered low risk, They were both healthy in their 20s with no chronic illnesses. But little did the police know that this case was about to get a whole lot stranger.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
So far, the police were zeroing in on Colin. He was an unlikely suspect, but all the evidence and signs were pointing right at him, and they knew all they had to do was follow the leads in order to answer their questions. And they still had many. As they dug through the computer forensics, they saw Colin was very active on a website called extramaritalaffairs.com. A website whose purpose is pretty self-explanatory. He was talking to a few women from all over the world, but most of his contact was with one woman in Wales called Helen Shepherd. They got in touch with Helen and asked her whether she knew a Colin Whelan. She sounded concerned and said of course and offered the police any help they needed. They went to Wales and met with Helen, who claimed to be in a long-term relationship with Colin. When they told her Colin had a wife who died, she didn't seem surprised. She said that she knew his wife was dead, that she died in a car accident just a few months after they had married, right? They broke the news to Helen, who was distraught and traumatised. This was the man she was hoping to marry, she told them. In fact, the week when Mary died, she had been planning on visiting Colin before he cancelled. Colin had sold her the sun, the moon and the stars. He said he was about to come into a large fortune, and the couple had spoken about moving in together when he would eventually buy a property in Wales. His phone records show that he had called her the day he killed Mary, and that he was researching accommodation in Wales as well on that day. Police also started to gather forensic evidence that would help bolster up their case. They spoke to the emergency services, who were called to tend to Mary on that morning, and they told police about how Colin had no blood on his hands, on his mouth, despite him claiming that he was performing CPR. In fact, no blood was found on the stairs, in the hall or on the phone, despite Mary bleeding profusely from her nose and her mouth. They did, however, find traces of blood on a shirt belonging to Colin that was in the bedroom, and blood splatter on the walls of the bedroom as well. This led police to believe that Mary had definitely been murdered in her room. Her body had been moved. Colin staged an accident, called 999 and pretended to resuscitate his wife, who was long dead. So they knew he was a liar, they knew he was a con man, and they were pretty sure at this stage he was a murderer. Along with the massive insurance policy, they also had a motive. They just had to tell him. Police would arrive at Colin Whelan's family home to arrest him on suspicion of the murder of his wife, and when they did so, he did not seem bothered or surprised. He didn't react or resist arrest and was taken to Balbriggan Garda Station. During questioning, Colin got slightly emotional but didn't break down or admit anything. He mostly answered no comment to the majority of questions asked to him by the Gardaí. Colin Whelan was then charged with the murder of his wife. He was brought to prison but ultimately given bail. In a documentary that I watched for my research called The Killing of Mary Gough, Superintendent Dominic Hayes said that it's not unusual in a murder case in Ireland for those to be charged to be given bail, because the wait for a trial can be up to 2 years and judges don't usually like people sitting in prison awaiting a trial, unless they're considered a flight risk or a danger to others. So most are allowed to wait for their trial in the comfort of their own home. Colin Whelan was given bail under the circumstances that he remained in Balbriggan with his parents and that he would sign in with an officer every week and provide a cash security. For 2 years, Colin Whelan adhered to these conditions, signing in at Balbriggan Garda Station every single week. All was going well, they were preparing for trial, until one day, his family called the Gardaí, reporting him missing. On the 12th of March 2003, Colin announced to his family that he was going out on a drive to Howth, a seaside village on Dublin's north side. They had noticed his mood to be understandably low and getting worse as his trial was on the horizon. At this time, he was scheduled to stand before the criminal court in 7 months. The Whelan family told the Garda about Colin's drive and they made their way to Howth, where they found his car in a car park. Colin's 2001 Peugeot 206 was parked neatly, and on inspection, police noticed that the car keys remained inside, alongside an empty bottle of gin. The car window was left ajar. This being a cliffy area that was known to be a location where suicides had taken place, the police began searching. They found no trace of Colin or his body. They called his phone and there was no response. They checked his phone records, and the last call that he made was to the Samaritans, an emergency line for people who are considering suicide or self-harm. But the call only lasted for 1 second. If this were anyone else, Gardaí would have easily tied this up to be a suicide. But the Garda knew Colin Whelan. The entire scene, just like the murder of his wife 2 years ago, was methodically planned out. Marie Gough, Mary's mother, said she believed Colin Whelan had help when he faked his own death. He had to be helped. That's the way I feel, she said. To me, you can't do all those things on your own. The Gough family did not believe Colin had killed himself, but the Whelan family did. Police remained looking for him, who they feared had left the country. A massive media operation began, asking the public to keep an eye out for Colin, who police feared was on the run. Interpol was alerted. All the Gardaí could do now was keep looking and waiting. This sparked a 14-month-long manhunt worldwide before a pair of Irish tourists claimed to have recognised him while on holiday in Spain. Colin Whelan had found hiding in Mallorca under a new identity and a new job. In the glamorous resort of Puerto Portals, he was working in a bar called Karma, a very upscale and fancy cocktail club. And he was known here as Martin or Keen Sweeney. Now, if you're Irish, this story will ring very true to you. There's a saying that everyone in the world has 6 degrees of separation. Unless you're Irish, then it's more like one or two. Two Irish women were vacationing when they made friends with a group of Englishmen who invited them out that night to their favourite bar, Karma. They were having the time of their life. They were on a budget holiday and here they were sipping champagne and dancing in one of the most glamorous clubs they'd ever been in. One of the women went to the bar and she came back and told her friend that the barman is from Ireland. So, doing what all Irish people feel compelled to do when they hear even a muttering of an Irish accent, she went to say hello to him. Marissa Mackle, who at the time was working for the Evening Herald, approached the barman and asked, "Are you Irish?" To which she got an immediately cold and frankly rude response. She realised she would not be making friends with him that night. She knew she recognised him, but she couldn't place him. A few weeks later, Colin would not be so lucky. A man, while on holiday in Spain, recognised Colin behind the bar. This guy knew exactly who Colin was. They'd gone to school together, and he knew Colin was wanted for murder. Colin seemed to forget that the Irish, wherever we are, will find each other and recognise each other. 9 times out of 10, if you run into another Irish person while on holidays, you're going to realise you know each other somehow. And Colin had somehow avoided this so far, despite the amount of Irish tourists who visit this area in Spain. Little did he know his days were numbered. The man who recognised Colin reported him to the Gardaí when he got home, and they finally had a lead. They found out that Colin had started a whole new life in Spain. He had a girlfriend, he had a group of friends, a pretty big one, and he had told everyone that his parents were dead and that he had no family. The Irish police reported this to Interpol, who started looking into things on their end. In the meantime, another woman came forward. Again, she had met Colin in a bar in Mallorca. He had actually given her his business card, which he had signed with his fake name, Cian Sweeney. The police got a hold of this business card and they were able to compare this signature with a signed statement that Colin Whelan had given, and the similarities were undeniable. Interpol were working in the background and they zeroed in on Colin's place of work, where they got a warrant for his arrest. At first, Colin Whelan denied that he was the man they were looking for. He said his name is Cian Sweeney, not Colin Whelan. But the jig was up. They took his fingerprints and they compared them to the prints the Irish police had, and it was a match. Irish police couldn't figure out how he got over to Spain though, since part of his bail conditions was that they had his passport. Ever the schemer, it turns out this was another one of his plans. He had found out all that he could about one of his neighbours, who he knew had no passport, and through the information he did gather, he was able to obtain a birth certificate, and from that birth certificate, he was able to get a passport in this man's name. When he settled in Spain, he had been vetted by Spanish police and issued with a national identity card in the name Martin Cian Sweeney, the name that was on his passport. Colin was extradited to Ireland, the first extradition of an Irish person back to Ireland ever from Spain, and went back to waiting on his murder trial. Garda began prepping for the upcoming trial, and when doing so, they got in touch with a former girlfriend of Colin who gave them an entirely new perspective on him as a person, who up until this point they thought had no history of abuse or violence. This girlfriend of Colin Whelan dated him in 1993, right before he met Mary, and said while at the start of the relationship he seemed all about her, he soon became controlling, intimidating, and violent. She said that she fell pregnant by Colin, who at this point terrified her. And when she told him he'd lost the plot, he turned up to her house one night with a bottle of vodka and aspirin and tried to force feed it to her to induce a back alley abortion. She resisted this attack, and that was when he kneed her in the stomach. The next day she suffered a miscarriage. She told police that when her and Colin were engaged sexually, he would often put severe pressure on her throat. When she found out how Mary had been killed, she said her blood ran cold. It could have been her. The trial began in April 2005, and up to this point, the Whelan family were still convinced of Colin's innocence. Whether it was wishful thinking or just ignorance of what the Garda had on him, remember, none of the evidence found on the computers or forensic evidence would have been public at this stage. Either way, they turned up to court in full support of Colin. The Goffs were understandably anxious. They had been living in what Marie Goff described as a limbo state for years now. Colin's lack of accountability had put them through hell and back, and they couldn't rest easy or move on until he was put behind bars. When the judge asked Colin what plea he would be entering, he answered, guilty. His family were stunned, as were the Goffs, who, although they had always known Colin had killed Mary, hearing the words from his own mouth was another thing altogether. Marie, Mary's mother, would later say, Mary loved Colin so much, and I wonder now, did he ever love her at all? Did he think so little of her and us? We thought he was a grand, normal chap. You never think someone you know would be capable of such a horrific act. Mary's brother, the one who walked her down the aisle, would say that the one thing Colin did for their family was spare them going through a long and drawn-out trial. This way they didn't have to be forced to see crime scene photos, hear of his planned-out actions, and relive the trauma of Mary's death. Defence barrister Mr. Hugh Hartnett read an apology to the Goff family on behalf of Colin Whelan, saying, I live with this regret and sorrow for the rest of my life. There are no words to explain my act. I apologise for the protracted delay today, and I apologise for taking your daughter, friend and soulmate so unnecessarily. He said he was a person of cowardice and that he accepts full responsibility for Mary's death. Colin Whelan was sentenced at the Central Criminal Court in Dublin on the 12th of April 2005, and upon sentencing, Judge Paul Carney called the murder the most calculating and callous killing that I have ever encountered in my time in court, before passing a mandatory life sentence. In normal circumstances, Mr. Justice Carney said he could backdate the sentence to account for the period spent in custody, but since the accused had absconded from the state, he said he would not do so. David Goff, Mary's brother, addressed Colin Whelan directly, who failed to meet his gaze, as David read his impact statement, saying, "On the 1st of March 2001, you, Colin Whelan, strangled my sister Mary, and for that we'll never, ever forgive you. You caused devastation to our family when you brutally strangled her, and you took a piece of us too. Then you fled the country, which shows you for the coward you are. You tried to rob us of justice. You thought you were above the law, but you are not. Justice has finally been done here today. Mary's only crime was loving you too much. No time in prison will ever be enough. The one thing you can't take away is the wonderful, cherished memories of Mary and the wonderful part she played in our lives. May she now rest in peace." Colin Whelan is a cut and dry psychopath. It's the Gardaí's opinion that Colin Whelan pled guilty that day to the murder of Mary Goff, not because he wanted to admit his wrongs, but because he wanted to control the information that would leak out about him. Once the evidence was shared in court, it would be public knowledge. He was merely attempting, for the last time, to save his reputation. The judge who sentenced him to life said on that day of sentencing that Colin was offered an immediate trial on the day of his extradition, which he denied. The judge believed this was a carefully planned tactic. He said that Colin was hoping that in the time passed between extradition and the trial, any jury may forget that he actually ran away to Spain. It's clear as day that Colin was not just a violent and sick individual, but that he had no care for anyone in his life. He didn't care about his own family, who may have helped him flee the country, which could have put them in danger with the police. He didn't care about the other women he dated, not his former partners, who he terrified, the women he met online, who he promised a life with, despite being married, nor the girlfriend he met in Spain, who was convinced he was another person this entire time. But most of all, he did not care about Mary Goff, someone who was totally devoted to him, who was trying to get healthy so she could start a family with the man who would ultimately kill her in her own home. We still don't know the exact events of that night in 2001, and Colin Whelan has never said what his real motive was, but it doesn't matter. Mary was killed. The Goffs were left without a sister and a daughter, and her life was taken by the one man they should have been able to trust. The man that Mary's brother gave her away to on her wedding day, just 6 months before she was murdered. Thanks for listening this week, everyone. I would love it if you would subscribe wherever you're listening. It really helps the show. And I'll talk to you all next week, where we'll be looking over to Hollywood to two suspicious deaths linked directly to the Playboy Mansion.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcasts.
We
anyone invite you to listen to our show?
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.